my time to talk about how applying a human rights framework can convert what it is that we do know about the key interventions to prevent women from dying into claims for political entitlement. My remarks are based on work I did with Physicians for Human Rights in Peru. PHR is going to release a report later this month and an accompanying video, documentary video as well. I'm not going to talk about the specific findings of the report per se, but I want to give you a flavor for what we did and kind of the application of the human rights framework. Peru, as many of you may know, is a context very different from Haiti, which is what I would describe as one of absolute deprivation. Peru, in contrast, is a context of dramatic disparities. In the region of the world that has the greatest inequalities in income, Peru stands out for its social inequities and for the very small amount that it invests in social services. It has the second highest maternal mortality ratio in South America after Bolivia. And maternal mortality, patterns of maternal mortality follow along those social fissures, so between rural and urban, along racial and ethnic lines, and also, of course, demonstrate dramatic gender inequality. What we did with Physicians for Human Rights was to try to personalize the story of maternal mortality and what it means to people's lives. So we identified cases of women who had died from pregnancy-related complications, both in childbirth and also from abortions, at home and at health centers, and we told their stories, what impact it had had, their deaths had had on their families and communities. But we also, very importantly, traced back the paths that led to their deaths and the decisions that were taken at the household level, the community level, the regional government level, the national government level, and in fact the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, they're actively engaged in health sector restructuring with a focus on the reduction of maternal mortality. So I want to share with you one of those stories and then talk about what a human rights framework adds. Evarista was, by all accounts, an exceptionally lighthearted and even playful woman, given the very hard life that she had. She lived with her common-law husband in Huancavelica, which is the most impoverished department in Peru. This was her fifth pregnancy. She had three children and one child who had died in infancy. All of her previous pregnancies had been normal. This pregnancy, and she had given birth at home. This pregnancy also had been completely normal. She had gone to 5 prenatal checkups, although her relationship with the health center was strained. She felt that, or according to her husband and other family members, she felt that they mistreated her, looked down upon her because she was indigenous. When she went into labor last December, in the middle of the night, her husband, Alejandro, did what is traditionally prepared, the mates, the oregano tea that is traditional, and a salve to put on her belly, and the labor went reasonably well. She delivered a baby girl at about 2 in the morning, but Alejandro quickly realized that something was dramatically wrong because the placenta was not delivered. He got his son from a first marriage to go call his older brother who lived next door. In a matter of minutes, his brother was there. Together they conferred and they realized they had to get help. There was no radio, no satellite, no cell phone communication, no means of communication with the health post. They decided to send his first son from a first marriage down the hill to the health post. And it's really more of a mountain than a hill. Extremely treacherous in the middle of the night, which was made even more treacherous because it had been raining. But Godifredo managed to make it down the side of this mountain without even a flashlight in slightly over an hour and a half, woke up the guard at the health post, who then proceeded to wake up the doctor, nurse, and midwife, and nurse's aide at the health post. It's unusual in Peru to have a doctor at a health post, but there was one in this case. They then decided to send the nurse's aide to attend this obstetric emergency. The nurse's aide left the health post with Godifredo, and they went, because there was no ambulance at this health post, went to find somebody in the town who would let them use the car to drive back up to Evarista. They finally found somebody. They borrowed the car. On the way back up the mountain, the car punctured a tire, causing yet another fateful delay. When it took about 20 to 30 minutes to fix the tire, they proceeded back up to the house. By the time they got there, Evarista's veins were hardening and she was already dead. Isabel excoriated Alejandro and saying that he had caused his wife to die because he hadn't taken her immediately when she went into labor. And the health post, in fact, took it upon themselves to punish Alejandro. They charged him a fine of 50 nuevos soles, which is about $16, to obtain a birth certificate for the baby, without which she could not be vaccinated or have access to government programs, because he had not had the delivery in the health post. Of course, he was unable to pay this, so he couldn't get access to those things until we appeared. So, what does human rights add to this? Well, we know from public health that the majority of maternal deaths are caused by these three deadly delays: the delay in the decision to seek care, the delay in arriving at care, and the delay in getting appropriate treatment once you're at care. We know from human rights that health facilities, goods, and services are to be made available, accessible, both geographically and economically, affordable, acceptable, culturally and ethically, and of adequate quality. And this lack of availability, accessibility, acceptability, and quality directly influences the three deadly delays. Of course, the social status of women feeds into the lack of priority for emergency obstetric care as well as the decision-making process. But even when, as in this case, there's a delay in the decision to seek care for which so often the family and the individual women are blamed, we can actually trace that often to inequities and inadequacies in the health system. Now, human rights has evolved quite a bit. It has something to say not just about laws and policies like restrictive abortion laws, but also about programmatic interventions. So in the general comment number 14, the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Committee states that the provision of essential obstetric services constitutes a basic obligation on the part of states' parties, such as Peru. That is, a core obligation for which the government bears the burden of proof in showing that it is expending the maximum extent of its available resources. Similarly, CEDAW, which is the committee that monitors the Women's Convention, advises states' parties to ensure women's rights to safe motherhood and emergency obstetric services. But we can go even farther in infusing concrete content into these normative obligations. We have guidelines that were jointly issued by the WHO and UNICEF and UNFPA, which are going to be now reissued with some newborn health signal functions, as Patsy mentioned, and called emergency obstetric services, which define signal functions, as Patsy pointed out, and also set minimum standards per population. So what does this mean in terms of human rights? Well, first of all, these deaths are not random biological events. They are the predictable result of systematic policy decisions at multiple levels of government. And human rights adds, it's not just bad health policy not to invest in the key interventions that are needed to save these women's lives. It's also inconsistent with a government's obligations under international law. In addition to emphasizing, underscoring the primacy of emergency obstetric care, human rights offers a set of principles that can inform and guide health policy making and the way we go about strengthening our health systems. So, for example, non-retrogression and adequate progress. Non-retrogression is a legal way of saying no backsliding. So if you have a national family planning program, essential, as Max pointed out, to reducing maternal mortality, you cannot then be a minister of health or have two successive ministers of health who belong to ultra-conservative Catholic sects that disapprove of contraception, dismantle that program. That is unacceptable and inappropriate under international law. You also have to make deliberate measures toward adequate progress, which of course begs the question of what are the indicators we're using to measure adequate progress. Meaningful participation. So not just tokenistic consultation, but a meaningful devolution of decision-making power to individual women and their communities. And then these other characteristics, non-discrimination, accountability and international assistance that I just want to go into a little bit more deeply because I think sometimes there are misconceptions about what human rights offers with regard to them. So non-discrimination is a paradigm, cross-cutting principle of human rights. And most people, or often people, think about it in terms of individual acts of discrimination. Discrimination by a health provider against a patient. And certainly that was at play in the case that I just recounted to you. Evarista felt mistreated by the people at the health post. She felt looked down upon and disparaged. That is something that human rights has something to say about, but it also has something to say about institutional and systemic discrimination. So institutional discrimination, like why aren't there health professionals who could speak to Evarista in Quechua, or a provision for somebody to translate. The lack of speaking the same language as the patient certainly affects accessibility and quality of care, as does the lack of an ability to give birth in keeping with her traditional birthing customs. But there's also systemic discrimination or structural inequality that results in de facto discrimination. So remember, under international law, we don't need discrimination to be deliberate or legal. It just needs to have the effect of nullifying or impairing the enjoyment or equal exercise of the right in question. And here, for example, in Peru, if you can see this chart, in Huancavelica, which is over right here on this side, there are over 90% of the population with unmet basic needs. And the people in Huancavelica receive a fraction of the amount of healthcare spending as people in Ica, or Moquegua, or Arequipa, or Tacna. And it just so happens that these populations under the line here are very highly indigenous populations, whereas the populations that are over the black line are much less so. So Peru not only spends a paltry amount of money on its health sector, 4.8% of the national budget, 0.9% of GDP, and it has decreased in recent years despite growth, it allocates that incredibly inequitably. So what does that result in? Well, it translates into fewer of the programmatic interventions that are necessary to save women's lives. So you see in Huancavelica, only 21% of women had access to skilled health professionals in the year 2000. So accountability. Well, accountability is probably the sine qua non of a human rights-based approach. I don't think it's necessary to say that there is a unique or sui generis approach that human rights lends. I think that human rights is consonant with many other understandings in social epidemiology and Latin American social medicine that see health as embedded in the wider conditions of people's lives. But what it crucially, most critically adds is a normative framework that is capable of establishing and mobilizing accountability. But what does that mean? Again, most people tend to focus on individual accountability, the individual perpetrator or health agent who does something wrong. So in this case, it turns out that Isabel, the nurse's aide, was promptly summarily dismissed in this case, even though there's nothing she could have done. And that kind of punishment, that kind of summary dismissal, that punitive attitude that Alejandro, that was exhibited toward Alejandro and his family of making them pay a fine to obtain the birth certificate, is also exhibited toward the healthcare workers on the front lines. And that misdirected punishment has perverse incentives and effects. So it's very likely, highly likely in this case, that the doctor and the nurse and the midwife decided to send Isabel, the nurse's aide, out to attend this emergency because they had a feeling Evarista was not going to make it. And they didn't want to be associated with that death because of this policy of summarily dismissing people whether or not they're negligent. So it has the effect of making people not want to actually attend obstetric emergencies. So we need to look beyond individual sanctions to institutional and systemic factors. Why did this health facility not have a radio or means of communication? Why was there no ambulance or a contingency plan in the event of such an emergency, for example? Obviously, accountability also goes beyond administrative and judicial redress. It has important political implications that are very linked to transparency, to participation, meaningful participation by people in healthcare decisions. Finally, international assistance and cooperation. Human rights is often taken to be exclusively about the nation state and the obligations of the nation state. But actually, in international instruments, there is explicit language calling for international assistance and cooperation. And these rights, the rights to health and education and other social rights, cannot be realized in the Global South without international assistance and cooperation. Anne mentioned the MDGs. MDG 8 calls specifically for a global partnership for development, for donor countries to step up if they want developing countries to meet the first 7 MDGs. And increasingly, human rights is recognizing that it does have something to say about this. The Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health has been very eloquent in this regard. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights is also increasingly talking about this. I think it's absolutely essential that our notions of accountability under human rights push into the realm of non-state actors and donor states. It may not be as fanciful in Peru as it is in Haiti or many other countries in the world that the government could do a whole lot more than it's doing. But Peru is nevertheless a highly indebted country. It spends 4 times as much annually on debt service as it does on the entire health system. And if we expect the government to dedicate the maximum extent of its available resources to essential obstetric services, then that maximum available resources is really reduced to pretty meager crumbs if we accept that they still have to continue paying off this debt burden. So, in conclusion, the lack of available, accessible, acceptable, and quality emergency obstetric care is a primary way in which women like Evarista and all over the world experience poverty and exclusion. Maternal mortality provides this kind of social x-ray that in Peru illuminates the interactions among rural poverty, gender inequality, and racial and ethnic discrimination, but also crucially the inadequacy of the health system and how it reinforces rather than ameliorates those underlying inequities. The MDG Task Force report on child and maternal health, very importantly in my view, underscored how health claims, claims to care and to the underlying preconditions of care, are assets of citizenship. And we see in Peru how rural, campesina, indigenous women are not fully citizens in Peru. They're not treated as full citizens. But at the same time, taking this kind of human rights-based approach that focuses on emergency obstetric care as an aspect of an integrated health system and connects it to these broader principles that link health with democratic governance and substantive equality can be an important step toward promoting, facilitating that more inclusive social citizenship. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ali. So I didn't do a very good job of moderating. We don't have very much time left for questions, unfortunately, but with the speaker's indulgence and yours, if you're interested, we'll stay a few minutes over the 2 o'clock time limit. So we'll take questions for a few minutes and then go from there. Thanks. If there are any. Yes. Len? To what extent are the human rights approaches that Ali talked about integrated into the partnership approach, I guess, addressed to Anne? Yeah? Okay.
That's a somewhat difficult question to answer. I think in terms of the advocacy work that linkage is very much there. In terms of the effective, well, Francisco Songane is the director of the partnership secretariat, as you probably know, and he was very involved in the Millennium Task Force, particularly focusing on MDGs 4 and 5. So he is, I think, he personally is very familiar with this human rights-based approach, and I, from conversations I've had with him, I think he's very strongly committed to it. The partnership's actual work plan on these issues is still under development, and the I think the working groups that are looking at this issue for effective interventions, for advocacy, and to some extent for monitoring and evaluation are still, you know, kind of figuring out how they're going to approach these issues. But I think there's a good opportunity for this perspective to be fully integrated. It's just, I wouldn't say it's totally there yet.
Sure. In the back, I just want to remind everybody to please fill out the evaluation forms. If you came in late and did not get one, hit your neighbor and see if they can give you one. And we'll pick them up at the end of the session. In the back?
It's not the one the Plateau Central to cover in terms of prevalence. It's 30%, but it's all over the country. But again, it's the poverty. It's the poverty. So why? When you have a woman with one or two children, and the man left this house, and she needs to survive with these children, and she has to get another man in this life. Even all of these women, they are part of this family planning program. They used to take on pills on the proper vera, you know, for every time. But that's the way is it, that they have a lot of children. So we need to reinforce this program, you know, try to integrate all of this HIV AIDS program with a lot of money, try to keep a comprehensive integrated, you know, project. That's what where I'm taking. We can keep this money, but for the last 20 years, Haiti got some money around our family planning program. But we think we lost all of this money because they go all of this HIV/AIDS program. So the first, I think it's a poverty, and we need more funding around our family planning program. Yes, I understand this depot poverty things because for now, we don't have any IOD. We cannot sequence of IOD. Why? And we receive all of this method from the Ministry of Health. We don't buy them like we used to go to the IDA themselves, like our program. We can buy some drugs through IDA and Boston, but not for the family planning pills, not for the IUDs, not for the Norplan. We receive them directly from the Ministry of Health. And if I go to the Ministry of Health now, asking for IOD, there's no IOD. So it's tricky.
Okay,
it's now it's all over Haiti. 30% of the deliveries at the institutional level, 70%, you know, deliveries at home by traditional birth attendants.
So in your catchment area, how long is the
practice? Even in our catchment area, the service is free. We have human resources around our healthcare centers. It's around 30-35% deliveries. Even care is free. You have some human resources. Why? Why? Because you need to be prepared to receive all of these deliveries to a healthcare center when you have only one midwife, nurses, two or three RN or one nurse auxiliaries. They cannot, you know, offer for 2,000 deliveries in a healthcare center like that.
I was just wondering if you have a strategy for incrementally increasing.
Yeah, one of the so it's two things. It's try to increase the level of your staff, not only the level, try to get more human resources, try to get more spaces. Like if you came to my one of our healthcare center, it's 110 beds. So when I used to go to some one of our hospital, we are doing not only C-section or vaginal deliveries, doing some pelvic surgery. It's only for 10 beds. So it's you should be have enough space, enough human resources, and more money, you know, to implement the service. In terms of strategies, we try to, again, try to get more money, more spaces, more human resources, and at the same time, we will bring more deliveries to the healthcare center through the TBAs, giving them some incentive, even try to bring them to the healthcare center to participate to the deliveries with the team.
Actually, the report, which, by the way, if anybody would like a copy of the report, please write your name down and email, and I will make sure that PHR gets that list. The report goes into some depth about the United States' obligations. The obligations of international assistance and cooperation are not well defined under international law, but it is clear that the United States, even though it is a signatory and not a party to these various treaties, does assume an obligation not to actively obstruct or contravene the object and purpose of the treaty. So, for example, actions taken by USAID with respect to emergency contraception, which is legal in Peru, where USAID attempted to apply the global gag rule to emergency contraception and forced grantees to actually return monies, was, we argue, an act of interference and a violation of those obligations. We also urge the United States to join Germany and other countries in the Global Fund's debt for health conversion, which Peru is one of four pilot countries, where there's a debt forgiveness conditioned on putting the money into the health.
Okay, thanks. And last one, Lisa.
Well, if you've worked there for many years, maybe you can elucidate that. There's a wonderful article that came out a couple years ago that looks at the uses Mozambique as a case study, and I can't remember if it's Tanzania or Kenya. It's another African country that basically looks at the long history of why it's not there and what has been done to get it there. And I know Mozambique, when we started working there in 2000, it was not on the list, and it was one of the drugs that the project bought. It is now on the list, and it is made available. I can tell you one thing that I know about that example is that I think a lot of physicians weren't aware of the evidence, and I think they were very slow at communicating with the Ministry of Health and with the organism within the ministry that purchases and procures and distributes the drugs. I don't remember the name of the group, but there is, and I think all countries have that group within the ministry. And there was a lack of communication, as amazing as it sounds, that the people in the ministry didn't even know that people wanted the drug. So there hadn't been, you know, that link. But sort of apart from that example, I can't give you a lot of other anecdotal information. I know we've heard a lot of providers talking about how they're afraid of using it. They're afraid of the side effects. But some of that is just a question of, you know, it's training and supervision and looking at protocols, and you test the reflexes, and you have calcium gluconate around as an antidote. And so I think a lot of it is, it's an information problem, it's a communication problem, and it's certainly I pointed out the problem with the pharmaceutical companies. Certainly, no incentive there. Maybe someone else can tell us more.
Thanks, Patsy. I have very little knowledge about that issue, but I do. I was leaned over to Anne and said actually that session at Women Deliver was very good. I understand Engender Health, along with some other organizations, is actually starting another big initiative with MagSulfate to really try and get it to a lot more countries and get it down to the clinic level and being used. The other issue that came up during the talk was the actual production and procurement of MagSulfate itself, and the fact that it's such a cheap thing that no pharmaceutical companies make it any longer for a large international market. So they're looking into production ways and ways to encourage some pharmaceutical firms to actually start producing it, because I think there's actually a shortage of it as well. Or there would definitely be a shortage if it were used to the extent that needs to be. I'm sorry, we have to wrap up. A couple of us are on panels at 2:30, actually. So thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And thanks to our panelists.